Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He's back on the podcast for a third time. Please welcome back Aidan Dodson. The first time we talked about ancient Egypt in general, and the second about the pharaohs. And this time, we're going to talk about misconceptions about ancient Egypt. We did a similar misconception episode about medieval era with Eleanor Yanigra, which I highly recommend to watch. It's kind of fantastic, and it's one of the most watched episodes of the podcast. Now, you've been on there before, and of course, let's recap real quickly how. And you also said you've been to Egypt about 95 times now, I believe, since last time.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure how many times I've been to Egypt. It must be getting on towards 100. I've never counted up my entry stamps in my passports, but it's been a lot anyway.
Yeah. So how did you get into ancient Egypt in the first place?
It was just something which I got into when I was about 7 or 8. I remember joining the local library for the first time, and there were these books with skeletons in them, which is sort of a 7-year-old is always quite fascinating, which were books on archaeology. And sort of almost, you know, within a few months, it was purely Egypt I was reading about. It was my sort of passion as a child. Did it at university, and here I am sort of 50 years later as professor of Egyptology at Bristol University. So it just happened.
Right. What's it like going back to Egypt? Is there always something new every time you go there?
Oh, yeah. I love the country anyway. And actually, a couple of months ago, we went on a cruise from Aswan to Cairo, which I'd not done for something like 30 years. And again, although I've done the journey more than once in the past, it always feels different. You know, the light, you know, different times of day, and things like that. So it always looks and feels different. And also, when you're going to archaeological sites, there's often new things which are being opened up to visitors. You get to chat to colleagues who have just found something. You know, on this last trip, when we were in the Valley of the Kings, one of my friends and colleagues was working there, so he spent a bit of time talking about what he was doing there and things like that. So it's always just a nice place to be, and you know, large numbers of friends there as well who it's nice to catch up with.
Right, so let's just start on the first misconception. Now, that's perhaps the most elephant in the room here, which is aliens did not build the pyramids, did they?
not in the slightest. I think the problem with these kinds of ideas that stupendous works of architecture and art in the past simply couldn't be done by what people call primitive people. But in fact, technology hasn't really start advancing until very, very recently. And nobody ever starts alleging that the great cathedrals of Europe were built by aliens. I think the problem with the whole alien hypothesis, if you can call it that, is actually it's fundamentally a racist idea whereby brown people and black people can't build great, great things. And as there were no white people in Egypt at that particular time, the alien hypothesis enthusiasts insist it must have been somebody from outside teaching these brown people how to do it, or even doing it themselves. So we end up with the idea of aliens building things. Also, those who are slightly less mad may say they are people from Atlantis or from some other sort of legendary location. But the bottom line is
really into Atlantis, isn't it?
Sorry?
Matt Hancock is really into Atlantis idea, isn't he?
Yes. Graham Hancock's current Netflix thing is a particularly horrible example of that, of this kind of thing. And also, what is particularly distasteful about people like Graham Hancock and the other enthusiasts is the way that they insult archaeologists, claiming that we sort of are trying to hide some kind of truth from the masses, and that we're that you know, all our decades of research is all nonsense. And that is another side of this whole thing. They sort of there's the overall idea that it's somebody else. But then when you start going into the implications of that, and the fact that people like me are liars and cheats, all those things are grossly offensive. And I think people who sort of seem to like the alien or Atlantean hypothesis really need to understand what that actually means. It means they're fundamentally racists and people and just and like bad-mouthing scientists. That is really the important thing. They need to recognize what this sort of apparently sort of cuddly and quite sort of and fun idea of aliens building pyramids really all is all about. And
You
actually,
just
when
sorry for disturbing you, but I just want to say you remind me of kind of similar thing with the Great Zimbabwe that has been neglected for years that Africans should not have built this. This must been this that that should not be possible, you know. That's you kind of remind me of the Great Zimbabwe
Oh, yeah, I
in
think
that part,
it's another aspect of the same thing. Because then, of course, they bring in the Queen of Sheba and all those sorts of things into these ideas about Great Zimbabwe. And so I think that's it's important to recognize what these sort of fringe lunatic ideas really are all about. And they're fundamentally wrong. And as we're sort of, I'm say, lighter note, you know, people who accuse us archaeologists of having sort of conspired to hide the truth. Clay has never met an archaeologist. We're the most argumentative bunch of people on earth. We can't even agree on little details of Egyptian history, let alone agree what great conspiracy to put together to hide the fact that the aliens built the pyramids or they were built by Atlanteans or any sort of outsiders from that. You know, that's just not the way, you know, the lack, if you go to a conference of archaeologists, the lack of agreement on almost everything makes it completely impossible that we could ever be sort of gang up and try and come up with some kind of conspiracy. We'd spend another 10 years trying to work out which conspiracy we should be going with rather than anything else. So, now it's a whole. There are so many aspects to these sort of the ancient astronauts. Arguments, and it is really, really very, very annoying in the way that it distracts people from actually understanding what the realities are of these things. The only upside, I suppose, it does actually make some people interested in the ancient world, and then some of them may sort of see the error of their ways and go over to the what you might call the from the dark side to the light side. And in fact, there is one particular Egyptologist who again was originally sucked in by some of the sort of more wacko side of things, but then he saw the light, went off, got a PhD, and is now a leading archaeologist. So there is an upside to this whole thing, but it is, you know, when people like Graham Hancock can get sort of 6-episode series to spout their rubbish, whereas just trying to get you know, just anything more mainstream on TV is really difficult. And the number of times I've been involved in the development of what would be a really, really good program or even sort of short series, but then the money isn't made available because it's not sexy enough.
Yeah, that's all about sexiness, isn't it? So they're going to keep talking about the pyramids for a wee bit longer, and I want to talk another misconception, and this is of course as probably a Hollywood fantasy that the pyramids weren't really booby traps, were they?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting about sort of the whole idea that pyramids had booby traps or tombs in general do. They don't have booby traps in the sense of things which like trip wires and things to sort of to bring things down on people. But over time, there was an increasingly sophisticated set of security arrangements, more to do with the way if you seal to seal the thing up. Because the earliest pyramids, effectively, it's just a straightforward passageway from the entrance on the north side down to the burial chamber. So even those very, very earliest ones do often have a portcullis involved. So a block of stone can be lowered down through a shaft from the surface to actually block the passageway. And what then happens over the generations of pyramid building is that they make that more elaborate. So rather than having one portcullis, you have two portcullises or three portcullises. Then, having experienced the fact that pyramids are being robbed by tomb robbers, the next step is to get away from always having the entrance on the north side, because that was a dead giveaway. So therefore, about 1,000 years on in pyramid building, they move the entrance to other locations. And then the next thing is you start having much more elaborate ways of sealing chambers. So rather than just simply a portcullis slid from above, you'll sometimes have almost hydraulics run by sand, which allow whole chamber roofs to be lowered after the burial. So that rather than simply breaking through it, there's no doorway. You've got this 4 or 5 foot thick ceiling and walls to try and get through as well. And those sort of things, you know, are quite elaborate, but those are all triggered by the funeral party who then leave, rather than the robbers themselves. Though there is actually quite a nice, accidental situation of robbers bringing down death on themselves. It's that there was a tomb was found back about 100 years ago, and the archaeologists found that the ceiling had collapsed. And when they cleared the ceiling, they then found the skeleton of a tomb robber squashed on top of the coffin. Because clearly when the tomb had been opened, the change in the atmosphere had caused some of the rock to crumble, and it came down smack on top of the tomb robber. So that sort of is the nearest thing, but that's more a natural booby trap rather than a real one.
And then set up like pits with snakes in under.
Not the slightest. You do have pits, but again, they're not to fall down because they're too obvious. What they are there for is to stop people getting through the neck onto the next over to the other side. Mm. And of course, things like, you know, the snakes wouldn't live very long.
Yeah, that's
true. So basically, also what you're trying to do is simply either make it almost impossible for the robber to proceed, you know, shafts, great blocks of stone, and occasionally in some of the very, very last pyramids to be built, they even have dummy passageways to mislead the robber as to where he should go. And there is one pyramid, almost one of the last great pyramids to be constructed, albeit never finished, which even got a dummy burial chamber in it. There's one burial chamber which is very obvious, and clearly wasn't the real one, and the real one was sort of embedded deeply in the rock, and with the robbers being distracted. So they certainly do go towards the end some really, really elaborate kinds of ways of protecting, but it's always to do with stopping people getting there rather than doing nasty things to them while they're on route.
So I read somewhere, in a magazine, I think, where the robbers, when they were stopped by stones in a way that were, like you said, were pushed down, they just digging themselves above the stones.
Oh, yeah. This is half the problem. Yes, you're quite right. That normally pyramid passageways are cut milt of fairly soft limestone. And of course, again, they may well put a big granite portcullis in the way. But of course, all you can then do is just chisel round the outside of it and get past. So a lot of it, I think, is not to stop them completely. They know that that's maybe impossible. What the hope is to do is to slow them down sufficiently so the police can get there and catch them. The problem, which is fine in periods where you haven't got a corrupt police force and things like that, but it seems that most of the major tomb robbery takes place when there's some kind of civil war going on or some kind of revolution, when the police are no longer in place or the police are corrupt and can be paid, you know, being paid by the tomb robbers. So, but I think the whole thing is more to try to do with delaying rather than absolutely stopping them. Because if you can't, if this tomb robber's got long enough, he is pretty, you know, he will manage to find the way in eventually. And that's true. Even in the most elaborately protected pyramids, they've all been robbed because eventually the robber could spend, you know, a month or whatever chipping through granite or quartzite if necessary to get to the burial chamber.
And there's one last thing about the pyramids I want to talk about before we move away from them, and that is that the pharaohs did not bury, and there was no slaves who did build them, and they did not die. I believe it is just this in the second episode, which is almost 2 years ago now. And but they did not kill their workers of the pyramids to hide where the tomb really was.
Not in the slightest. The pyramids and later on the tombs in the Valley of the Kings were all built by skilled labourers. And certainly there would be no desire to, you know, to put the death or anything like that because their expertise is needed for the next pharaoh. The idea, the question about using slaves for pyramid building is an interesting one because it partly depends on how you define slaves. Certainly pyramids were not built by slaves in the sense of people who are permanently subjugated, and forced to work. However, it's likely that during the time when the Nile flood took place, when the fields were covered with water, that the farmers who are no longer able to work on the fields may well have been conscripted to do some labouring, dragging blocks and so on, just up to the building site where the skilled labourers could pick up on what they were doing. Whether you could call that slavery or simply compulsory labour, it's a different. You know, it's a bit. It's the subtlety there, because many sort of societies have situations where people, where members of the population are obliged to do public service at some point or other. So I think the nearest you're going to get to what the sort of Hollywood sees as slaves doing it is when you've got people who are normally farmers being brought in to do some heavy lifting and heavy dragging during the inundation season. And also, the reason that's also when you're going to need that kind of unskilled dragging labour, because it's during the inundation when the water of the Nile comes right up to the edge of the desert, is when you can actually bring in stones and other things from outside the building site. Because the majority of the stone for building pyramids is quarried directly at the pyramid site within a few 100 meters or so. But there are the more exotic stones, like the better quality limestone used for the casing, which has to be brought from the other side of the Nile. Then you've also got things like granite, quartzite, and things which come from other parts of Egypt. So that's when you're bringing all that stuff over on rafts and boats. And then you're going to, and that's when you need the extra labour. And it's probably worthwhile noting that in a couple of years ago, the logbooks of one of the people who ran one of the ships delivering these blocks from across the river was discovered. We've actually got the actual logbook of somebody who was intimately involved in building the Great Pyramid by bringing the casing blocks over from the other side of the Nile.
That's amazing.
Yeah, though they were interesting. These papyri, which are actually the oldest papyri known from Egypt, were actually found on the Red Sea coast because the ship's captain also worked running boats on the Red Sea as well. So clearly his office was over there, and that when eventually, you know, they got rid of the old logbooks, they were left on the Red Sea coast. So it's quite remarkable how a discovery, you know, many miles from the pyramid sites actually brings us right face to face. And that's, of course, another thing which one can throw at the alien and whatever protagonists, is we've actually got now a pieces of papyrus written by people who were building pyramids or involved in the supply chain of building pyramids. So it's we have more than adequate evidence as to who is building pyramids and why and everything else, all of which tend to be completely sort of ignored by the aliens and Atlantean people. And I have to recommend the book. It's called The Red Sea Scrolls, which was published a few months ago. So it's a bit of a pun on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but The Red Sea Scrolls are published by Thames and Hudson, which I think should be compulsory reading for anybody who vaguely wants to get involved in the ancient aliens hypothesis, because this absolutely nails exactly who was building the pyramids and why and everything else.
Right. Yeah, and let's move away from the pyramids, because one of the most infamous and misconceptions that has been for the past 2,000 years, I think, now, that the Egyptians did not enslave the Israelites. So, well, how come that ended up in the Bible, and why has they put on the Egyptians kind of like a bad answer? Again, is this kind of like a racist thing, or is it like...
I'm not sure. It is possible they did enslave the Israelites. However, the evidence for such only comes from the Bible, in the sense that that is how the Israelites present themselves to posterity. There's certainly no evidence from Egypt itself that the Israelites ever existed. The idea that foreigners like the Israelites might have been enslaved is... it's not unreasonable. Certainly, if they had been captured in warfare, we certainly know that the Egyptians enslaved prisoners of war, or again made them do forced labor anyway. But the idea of simply an ethnic group would suddenly be enslaved on a whim, there's certainly no obvious parallel to that, as far as one can see. The Egyptians' views on resident foreigners was that they were simply, you know, that they were the members of the population, and they were let get on with things. So the scenario which the Bible presents regarding the Israelites is unlikely. There's also, say, the big question, because the whole thing only comes from the Bible side. They say there's no objective data from the Egyptian side. Is that the whole thing may well be a spin? The whole biblical account may be a spin doctor's version of something which we do know happened, which was when the Hyksos, a bunch of Palestinian rulers, oppressed Egypt for 100 years and then were expelled. Now it's quite possible. One theory is that amongst the Hyksos were the people who later became the Israelites, and rather than being the ones who were being oppressed by the Egyptians, they are the ones who oppressed the Egyptians and were thrown out by the Egyptians because the Egyptians got fed up with being oppressed by the Israelites and their Hyksos friends. And this would be this is a sort of thing which you tend to know. You find when you look at sort of propagandistic accounts of things that you wouldn't. If you think about when the biblical stories are being developed, probably around campfires, public readings, and so on, in the sort of 1,000 years between the events they purport to describe and when they're actually written down, about 500 BC, are they going to say? Now, when you're asked, well, why did you leave Egypt? You're not going to say, well, we'd been oppressing the Egyptians for a century and they got fed up with us and threw us out. They're going to try and turn the whole thing round in a more propagandizing way. So I think if the whole Israelite episode actually happened at all, I think it was more likely to have been the other way round, that they were part of a Palestinian group who were oppressing the Egyptians and they were expelled. The fact that they had been in Egypt for a period of time and then had left was clearly something which was part of their sort of their whole popular myth. But of course, they had to make it more favourable to themselves. So you do tend to find that the people who are doing bad things or have done bad things will always try and explain it away. Just look at sort of Putin in Ukraine. He's claiming that he's trying to defend Russia by invading the next door, his next door neighbour. So I think it's exactly that kind of thing which we felt is probably to be found. Why the Bible tells it one way when one has a strong suspicion it was the other way around completely.
You need the sympathy, right? You need the sympathy for it from the people.
Yeah. Yeah, but also you always, I think always, when in any kind of national history writing, you normally try and present yourself in the best possible light.
Of course.
And if you think about the way that sort of history has been written over the last couple of centuries, it's only very recently that former colonial powers, for example, have started to admit that what they were doing was not necessarily as altruistic as it was always presented at the time. You know, it was always.
If I can add an excellent book on that topic, when he's mentioned that colonials under the colonialism, Pierce Brennan's book on the decline and fall of Pierce Brennan's book on the decline and fall of the British Empire, that's an excellent example of that, of how uncovering the truth, if you will, on the British Empire.
Oh, but sorry, yeah, and I think it's true with the other empires as well. It's always, yeah, you know, you always want to make your own story sound better, and it takes quite a bit of time and also courage to start being able to admit that things were not as good as the propaganda used to put out. On the other hand, there is always a danger of going too far as well in the other direction. But objective history is something very, very difficult to write when particularly you are from a culture, the culture whose history you're writing. It's always just slightly easier to do it for as an outsider, doing it for as an insider. And given how important the whole creation myth of Israel is, one can see why objectivity doesn't really have a place in that.
Right. And I didn't add this to this, but I want to add it anyway. And I had Irving Finkel on in the summer, and he said, we discussed about games and antiquity, and we came across early writings like Rosetta Stone, for example. But he claims, and I'm not sure if you agree with him on this, but he claims that the pharaohs and hieroglyphs were not the first writing, that the Babylonians were the first writing. Do you agree with that?
It's one of those little battles that us and the Mesopotamian specialists have been having over the years. Who actually is the earlier? I think I would agree that probably Mesopotamia, Babylonia, has got the earliest surviving examples of real writing. The earliest Egyptian evidence is probably 200 or 300 years later. So I would probably agree that probably the Mesopotamians were the first people to have a meaningful writing system, and the Egyptians developed theirs quite possibly because they knew of what was going on in Mesopotamia. Mm. It's also worth noting that the very earliest Mesopotamian signs, before they moved into the cuneiform where we're familiar with for most of Mesopotamian history, was using pictures as the basis for their various syllables.
And those were not emojis. Hmm? They were not emojis.
No, at all. But they said they had the very earliest writing in Mesopotamia is based on a picture-based script,
yeah,
which then becomes very much then turned into cuneiform. So my suspicion is what happened was, because we know there is lots of trade going on between Iraq and Egypt and stuff going on at this period, is that traders and sort of other visitors from Egypt came back to Egypt saying, hey, over in Mesopotamia, they've got this way of writing. So therefore, the hieroglyphic script is developed, not in any way as a copy as such, but merely because they know that's what's possible in Mesopotamia. And therefore, that the Egyptians then take the same idea of using pictures for sounds, but then develop completely separately. So I think Irving is quite right that the earliest writing we have any knowledge of is Mesopotamian. It's a couple of years earlier, a couple of hundred years earlier. So I think it is where it all comes from, and that's where the inspiration for Egyptian hieroglyphs comes from. But so it's not, it's nowhere, I don't think, a direct borrowing, because the actual way that you, the signs work is totally different. But the idea, and I think that's, I guess, often the important thing when you look at how things develop around the world, is that it's often not a question of actually directly copying something. It's just getting being aware that you can do that sort of thing, and that is sort of where it comes from.
I mean, just look at the Greeks, for example. The Etruscan birthed from the Greeks, and the Romans birthed from the Etruscans, and then you got the modern alphabet that way, you know. So you see, I can see what you mean. Yeah,
yeah. It's often just the idea, and actually, in very late. There is actually an alphabetic cuneiform, which is done shortly before you start getting Phoenician writing, which is where sort of modern Western stuff originates. There's an idea that you can go down the purely alphabetic route because of course the various languages written in cuneiform and also in hieroglyphs. They're not purely alphabetic. There's a mixture of types of sound signs. The big leap was only having alphabetic signs. And what's interesting there is that as those come in Phoenicia, at around the same sort of time, people are trying to turn their attempts to have a cuneiform alphabetic approach as well. So again, I think ideas move, but exactly how you implement those ideas can vary from place to place.
Right. And that's brings us to the next misconception, and that is we discussed this. Actually, I got the idea for this. We kind of discussed this already in our episode on the pharaohs. That you said that the pharaohs weren't really called pharaohs. That's more a modern invention.
Sort of. Because there is an Egyptian basis to it. The thing is, the term pharaoh we take directly from the Bible. And in fact, the Bible seems to think that the word pharaoh is actually a name, because it talks about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, not on the pharaoh of Egypt. And that, say, has passed into the English language. And effectively, the word pharaoh has ceased to be anything other than simply a word meaning an Egypt, king of Egypt. It does actually have an Egyptian backdrop, however, but not until about 1500 or 1400 BC, because at that point you start seeing a word per'a, which is certainly the same word as pharaoh, appearing as a designation of the royal palace. And then, a few hundred years later, we start seeing per'a being used as the title for a king. So you actually have pharaoh so-and-so later on. So that seems to have been a development of what was originally simply a statement for the palace to be a title. And the idea of using sort of the word sort of a palace for a person is rather like in the USA, you say that the White House said so-and-so, which of course means the president said something, or in the UK, number 10 Downing Street said X. Which, of course, means the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom said so on. And I think there are parallels in other sets. Like, for example, the Sublime Port or the Beautiful Door became a term for the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, the Sublime Port. So this idea of the place and the person who lives in it becoming sort of coming together. So, yeah, the concept of using per'a or pharaoh as a designation for the king, or at least the kingship, probably say 1400, 1300 or so BC, but for the first half before that, not at all. So it is a bit of an anachronism if you talk about pharaohs who built the pyramids, because the pyramids were built at a time when per'a was never used. On the other hand, though, I think because the word pharaoh is now an English word and a German word and a Norwegian word and anybody else, because it's been brought in, I think one can be a little doesn't have to be too sort of purist about it, because I wrote a book on the first pharaohs a couple of years ago, and I actually had to make a point in the introduction to say that I'm using the word pharaoh as the English word meaning Egyptian king, rather than alleging that these people actually had the title, because there are certain colleagues and reviewers who get themselves remarkably worked up over stuff like that. So pharaoh. Yeah, the Egyptians did use it, but not until pretty late on in their history.
Do you have an academic title for the pharaoh that mostly academics use?
Not really. I think we just call them kings, king or pharaoh, quite honestly. Because the Egyptians themselves, they had a word which was Nesu, which meant the ruler, which we generally translate as king. There are probably a lot more subtleties involved in the various words which the Egyptians use for king, because there's more than one. But of course, when you're looking at a dead language, one can't necessarily get the subtleties. And also, we then are forced to come up with English translations for some of those titles, which, because we don't quite know what the difference is, you know, what the subtlety is, whether our translation is useful or not. So for Nesu, we say king. There's also another word for the king, Iti, which we translate as sovereign, not because it means the same as the English word sovereign, it's simply because it's a different word for the concept of kingship. And it brings a huge area of discussion when you're talking about myths about ancient Egypt or misconceptions and so on. Some of them are derived...
It's a feel of our itself, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of other misconceptions because people read an English translation of an Egyptian text where certain words have been used to mean a certain thing, or used for a certain thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean they mean the same thing as in English.
Sorry for interrupting you again, but want to compare that. It's like reading Caesar's Gallic War in English and not in Latin, right? Or reading Herodotus in...
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Translated. Yeah, yeah. And the best example is that we use the word harem for two completely different words in ancient Egyptian. And in neither case do they mean harem in the sort of sexual
Ottoman
way sense. One of them means is a word which seems to mean some accommodation for the royal family, not just simply women. And the other actually is a troupe of musicians.
That has nothing to do with the slave girls being used for the pharaoh's pleasure at all.
Yeah, not exactly. So the problem is that those words have been picked because you need an English word and people prefer to translate with a single word rather than a whole phrase. But also people then, again, if they don't read ancient Egyptian, will think that these two harems are the same thing as well. So I remember getting involved in a long discussion on Facebook, and I know one shouldn't do all such things, you know, about this. Somebody was arguing something, but hang on a second, which word should you translate as harem are you talking about? And it turned out they hadn't realised they were two separate words, and therefore they were arguing something completely impossible because they didn't know which of these words it is. And there's always a big problem with any kind of translations, you know, between languages, you know, between English and Norwegian. I'm sure there's lots of places where there isn't actually a one-for-one correlation between the two. And I know from other languages I do know, there's very much that problem. So it's another thing which sort of stokes myths about ancient Egypt or misunderstandings about ancient Egypt, is that people don't appreciate actually what the Egyptians are actually saying themselves, what some of the words actually mean, rather than... So I think I'm always very nervous when, certainly in the UK, there's a drive to really sort of allow people to study ancient Egyptian texts without actually learning any ancient Egyptian itself. Mm-hmm. They're simply learning it from learning about stuff from translations. And I think that's very, very dangerous, because unless you understand the subtleties as to why a word may or may not be appropriate, And also whether or not certain, you know, grammatical construction incorrectly, you know, put together.
I mean, I would kind of counter-argue, though, with you, because I think it's kind of a good thing that people want to learn this read this original text, and not everyone may have time to, you know.
Oh, I know.
Like ancient Egyptians, and they have to rely on these translations.
Oh, I agree completely. But I'm not talking about just people, just ordinary people who are interested. I think it's talking about from the point of view of people, sort of, you know, serious students. There are people who will study Egyptian texts at university without actually having ever learnt any ancient Egyptian. And I think that's dangerous. But no, of course, you've got to have, you know, these translations. But also people got to understand the limitations of them, that the translations say as much about the person who translated the text as the person who actually wrote it in, you know, 3,000-4,000 years previously. That there's always that when you make a choice, when you're translating something, there's always a choice about what words you use. And those are very much modern choices rather than reflecting, you know, which can impact what the tone of the text and everything else.
Right. We have a few more myths to cover before we go, and one of them is, I believe we discussed this in the first episode, we were on the second episode of the podcast as well, is that Tutankhamun was not really a big deal, was it?
Tutankhamun, whether he's a big deal or not, it very much depends where you're coming from. There's a lot of hyperbole about the tomb being the greatest discovery ever made. Which,
I mean, in the ruling sense, when he was
I know. I'm just thinking about them, just bringing that in as well. There's a lot of hyperbole about sort of the fact there's lots of gold and stuff. As far as Tutankhamun himself is concerned, he is important in the sense of where he fits in history, because he is the person under whom the dismantling of the whole religious revolution of Akhenaten takes place. But of course, as a child for much of his reign, he probably didn't have a huge amount of input into that. Mm. On the other hand, though, probably once he was sort of from his mid-teens onwards, he may well have done. But it's very much unclear how much of the very important stuff which happens during his reign is due to him and how much is down to his advisors, the people who are acting as regent for him. So the reign is really important, but the importance of him is very difficult to grasp. But on the other hand, if you look at sort of more recent history, being a teenager doesn't necessarily mean you're not influential. For example, Edward VI of England, the son of Henry VIII, he died when he was, I think, again, about the same sort of age as Tutankhamun, or even younger. Yet we know he had a very strong influence on the hardline Protestantism, which was introduced during his reign. And because he was only a teenager doing that. So because somebody is a young ruler who may have nominally somebody ruling on behalf of them, doesn't mean they're not important. So I think with Tutankhamun, his reign is important, but whether he is important is a much more difficult thing to get hold of.
But I would say, though, it seems that he had pretty good regent then, which is kind of rare, isn't it? Because it seems to me that quite a lot of regents want just power for themselves and for their own gain and power and stay in power. But it seems like he had actually decent regents. If he did, it is an important reign.
Yeah. Well, again, we don't really know, because the point is that all we know is that what happens is the dismantling of Akhenaten's revolution, basically. Now, the question is whether that is being done for, whether that is being done for reasons which the young king would approve of, whether they're being done for settling personal scores and so on. It's very difficult to know. I'm not sure you can say that he had good regents. All we can say is what actually happened, because we just haven't got any kind of data to understand whether or how what they were motivated by, and sort of whether they were indeed good. Because again, as we were talking earlier on about sort of when people want to present stuff, they always want to show themselves in the best light. And as one of his regents then went on to be pharaoh for a couple of decades, again, officially what happened during that time was a good thing, because that's what the Pharaoh says. So I'm not sure we can necessarily say that.
That's fair, yeah. Of course, there's one last myth, and this one's a more fun one. Of course, mummies does not come back to life.
No, there's not very much. Basically, there's not really enough left of a mummy to be able to do that. Bear in mind that the mummy is a dried out husk of a body with most of its organs missing, and unable to, and rather on the stiff side. It's amazing how much of what people think they know about Egypt is all to do with what Hollywood says to them. You know, and in fact, quite a few of the sort of misconceptions we've been talking about are ultimately stoked by the Hollywood position. Yeah. You know, the idea of slaves and all those kinds of things is, you know, is pandered to by Hollywood. And again, the sort of the idea of mummies as being malevolent beings and all those sorts of things. It's also interesting, actually, that when you that the idea of, you know, when you've got sort of, you know, when in sort of fantasy kinds of things to do with mummies, it things sort of change in the 1930s to between malevolent mummies. If you actually read some of the literature about mummies, you know, fantasies about mummies written prior to that, they were normally sort of much more sort of friendly creatures. So there's a whole interesting about the way that the mummy moves from being a possibly not exactly a cuddly thing for in literature to being a much more malevolent kind of thing as well. And also, of course, this ties in with the myths of Egyptian curses and so on. That, you know, any the curses which do exist are more to do with people who are trying to embezzle money from funerary endowments, rather than anything to do with sort of, you know, calling vengeance on anybody who might violate the tomb.
I mean, you do have the infamous curse of Tutankhamun,
which of course doesn't exist. The curse of Tutankhamun was made up by a journalist. What a surprise! Journalists make stuff up. Yeah, it was. And we're not sure who made it up. There's a strong suspicion it may have been a guy called Arthur Weigel, who had been an Egyptologist, had moved on to theatre set designing and novel writing, but then was hired by a British newspaper to cover the whole thing. And he was good at sort of spinning yarns. And I think what happened was that when Lord Carnarvon died of blood poisoning following a mosquito bite, that he was probably telling tall tales to his journalistic colleagues, which then sort of became more and more serious. And the most amusing thing about this is that when poor old Weigel died of cancer 10 years later, the newspapers accused the curse of Tutankhamun of killing him, when he probably made it up himself. So quite interesting, quite fun how all these things happen.
It's always a joy to have you back in the podcast, and you're, of course, always welcome back again in the future. Before you go, do you have anything you want to promote? Any social media, Twitter?
Well, just to say that my book on Tutankhamun, King of Egypt, His Life and Afterlife, came out a few weeks ago. And I have a book which should be out in about 10, 11 months' time, are the Nubian pharaohs of Egypt, their lives and afterlives, in a series which I'm now on, something like my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, my sixth volume in this particular series of lives and afterlives.
Sounds exciting. I'll make sure to look it up. And this has been One.H12. We are available on Twitter under One.H12, Instagram, One.H12. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on iTunes, please make sure to write a review if you liked our episode. And also, we made another misconception episode about the medieval era with Dr. Eleanor Yanagra, which I highly recommend checking out, and also check out other episodes as well. This has been One.H12. Please like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.
Right.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.